Case number 22-5238, Doug Goodman v. Commercial Bank and Trust Company. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. William Lewis Jenkins, Jr. for the appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lewis Jenkins. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Mr. Doug Goodman, and I've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
I'll just start by saying Doug Goodman had some checks that had been issued to him by Southern Risk Insurance Group and Doug Martinique. He took those checks to the bank on which they were drawn. I think that's an important fact for determining all the things that pertain to the disposition of this case on summary judgment. On the afternoon of December 4, 2020, he went and took those checks to the bank where they were drawn, which was the entity with the best knowledge about whether or not those checks were any good. He asked for those checks to be paid and for him to be issued. He actually asked for cashier's checks. What they gave him was technically a teller's check under the Uniform Commercial Code. And he took those away and attempted to deposit them then at his bank. And either that afternoon or the very next business day, the bank on which the original checks had been drawn and that issued the teller's checks refused to honor those teller's checks.
So your argument is that there's a distinction between mistake and negligence, or at least gross negligence. And I guess I'm not seeing either in the ordinary understanding of the word mistake or in the restitution why there is this distinction. It seems to me it's perfectly natural to say that I made a negligent mistake, meaning that it was my fault. Or even my gross fault, but it was still a mistake. It wasn't intentional. And I don't see why we should draw that distinction, which is your key distinction for why there wasn't a mistake.
Yes, sir, it absolutely is. I agree. I didn't mean to interrupt.
So I'm just curious how you garner this distinction from, I don't know, the ordinary understanding of mistake or the restitution, which doesn't, the restatement of restitution, which also doesn't seem to draw the distinction.
Well, in responding to both of those, Your Honor, I'll take up the easiest one first. I think the restatement of restitution does, in fact, and we cited Section 6 of the restatement, a comment to Section 6 of the restatement first of restitution, which is the same restatement that's cited in the comment of the statute, or the official comment of the statute. And in fact, I think that that would dispose of the case on its own because the comment restatement section restitution section 6 says that if it's a known unknown, as someone once said.
Well, maybe the UCC part of this is the harder question then. I think you sort of acknowledge that by taking the easy one first, but isn't the whole point of the UCC scheme to allow for sort of mass processing of checks? And on the back end, if a mistake has occurred for whatever reason, there's a mechanism in place to resolve that. But the point of the UCC is to allow sort of business as usual, subject to mistakes that might be found later on, and then we have this procedure that allows parties to address that. That seems to be what's articulated in the UCC and sort of what's happened here.
Well, so two things in response to that. First of all, yes, I acknowledge that the language of the comment to restatement first of restitution section 6 makes that the easier question. But to answer this question, I'll finish what I was saying to Judge Murphy, and that is that I've recited what I think are the plain language definitions of mistake, and those demonstrate that the second question is not much harder. And so, Judge Radler, in response to that question, I would say that if the language of the statute is plain, and if the meaning is not disputed, then we never get to this big question about the whole purpose of the UCC. And in fact, that purpose would not be served here. This case is not about the mass processing of checks. It's about one person at the bank.
Well, but cumulative. I mean, there's a lot of checks that go back and forth between banks every day. But there's also this comment three in to the UCC section that seems to be pretty much on all fours with this situation.
Well, I would say that I said in my brief I thought it was on all fours with this situation simply because both of those examples, the father giving the gift check to the daughter and the check kiting scheme, those are both of the examples from comment 3 to section 3418. Both of those examples demonstrate the comment, in fact, specifically says that the bank employee believed that the funds were there. The bank employee in this case did not believe that the funds were there. She had no belief about whether or not the funds were there. She, in fact, she was standing at the screen and could have had knowledge, but chose not to have knowledge.
Didn't she testify that she assumed they were there? It's just your point is that she didn't check.
That's not an assumption. My belief is that an assumption is not a belief, Your Honor. A belief is a belief that the funds were there. And if you look at the two examples in the comments, that's clear. The bank employee believed in the gift by the father, and the bank and the check kiting scheme was paying the checks over.
Does it mean that under your view of the facts, if a bank cashes a check of somebody who has an account at the bank, if they don't check to make sure that they have enough funds, it's always going to be disqualified from mistake status because they were knowingly ignorant?
That probably would be one of the implications of my argument, Your Honor.
Significant limit of this, isn't it?
It would not, because as Judge Radler already pointed out, the most of the time these checks are going to get processed in a mass batch, and here you've got an individual of the bank with the only opportunity to know whether the funds are there, and that person remains willfully ignorant of whether or not the funds are there.
I just forgot. So it's not willfully ignorant. It's just I had a lot of checks that I was cashing. There was a really long line. I know you dispute whether there was haste here, but assume that there was. They just forgot to do all the technical checks before cashing the check. That strikes me as a classic form of a mistake.
That's the reason I asked the question at the deposition, Your Honor, because I was intending the entire time, if I could, and once I got those answers, I knew that it was not a qualifying mistake.
So you would agree that it would be a qualifying mistake if it was in haste they just forgot to check?
We don't have that case here, and I'm unwilling to concede that, but I think that would be a closer call than the case that we've got now. I don't think that, respectfully to everyone involved, the district court, I don't think it's a close question, because she could articulate nothing about why she was in a hurry. There was no line. There was nobody waiting outside at the door behind Mr. Goodman. At summary judgment, all those facts were probably undisputed in favor of the plaintiff in this case. There was absolutely no indication that she was really in a hurry, that she really was pressed by any other business. She couldn't articulate anything to support that. She just tried to recite the language of the statute in her deposition. And I don't think a jury would believe that, which is what we had asked for in this case, and I certainly don't think that was a basis for summary judgment in this case.
Can I ask you a separate question? If we disagree with your position on mistake,
yes, sir.
Are you still contesting the argument that your client didn't act in good faith in cashing these checks?
So those two things go together, Your Honor, in my opinion. Because
separate parts of the statute, and the district judge found that your client knew that your client knew this was a mistake on the bank's part, and you don't really contest that in your brief.
Well, he didn't know that, and I did say that. I did contest that in my brief because we, especially particularly, I believe at page 34 of our brief, we put in there specifically that the good faith question is resolved by the fact that he took the checks to the bank where they were drawn. He had been there before. The facts were he had been there before, and they had refused to cash the checks. So he wasn't presenting the checks in bad faith. We discussed that in our brief. We discussed the honesty and fact standard. He didn't do anything dishonest.
There was quite an omission there, wasn't there? Why didn't he say, why didn't he disclose, I've been told that there might not be enough funds in this. Do you mind checking to see if there's funds? And if so, providing me a cashier's or tailor's check? He didn't do that, did he? Just didn't say anything.
I think that would be an appropriate question on cross-examination in front of a jury, Your Honor. But the fact is, it's not undisputed that he acted without good faith.
And the best evidence of that is because he went to the bank where the checks were written from. That's the evidence of good faith.
That would have to be the best evidence of good faith. Your Honor, I can't make those text messages that were exchanged between Mr. Goodman and Mr. Martinique that afternoon anything other than what they were. They don't say the money was there. They gave Mr. Goodman some idea that the money might be there, but they do not say that the money was there. I'm not trying to make those messages say something other than what they say. But I believe in going to the bank where the checks are drawn and in presenting them to the bank on which they were drawn, Mr. Goodman was acting with honesty in fact. And I'm out of time, so
yes, sir. Well, Judge Kethledge, do you have any other questions?
Briefly, and I apologize to everybody there that I can't be there today. I just wanted to, Mr. Jenkins, I just wanted to ask about the value issue. Your client, if there was a mistake, you have to show, among other things, that your client gave value for these checks. And I'm just wondering what you think that value would be. It doesn't look like your client gave Mr. Martinique a release. So what would the value be for the checks?
Well, there's the value, I think, Your Honor, I think that my argument on that point is that the deferral, I agree, there's no written release in this case, but I believe that under Tennessee law, Mr. Martinique and Mr. Goodman had an enforceable contract. And so I think the deferral of any further action was the value that he gave. I don't think
I guess I figured that might be your answer. I mean, reading your brief, it sounds like you think there's a partially executed on Martinique's part purely oral contract. Is that fair?
Yes, sir. That is absolutely fair, except for part of the contract was performed. The partial performance part was in writing because Mr. Martinique actually issued several checks, at least one of which, I think two of which, turned out to be good.
But I don't see anything in the record that shows your client doing anything that changes his legal rights vis-a-vis Martinique. I mean, he could have brought suit the day after he cashed these checks, for all we know. And said that, there was still another few hundred grand that was owing based on Martinique's conduct. So I guess if your client did not change his own legal rights in any respect by anything that happened here, what authority is there for the idea that he gave value in exchange for these checks?
Well, I think the basic idea of consideration under Tennessee law, Your Honor, is the best indication that I can produce that he gave value, because in asking that question, I think the court's question presupposes that there's a proper inquiry into the sufficiency of the consideration, and under Tennessee contract law, I don't believe that is a proper inquiry. Mr. Goodman gave some kind of value. I have argued that it is deferral. I think that deferral is sufficient consideration to support the contract that they resolved this dispute. in accordance with the payments that were made but then returned on behalf of Southern Risk Insurance Group and Mr. Martinique, Your Honor.
Okay, that's a helpful answer. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Battle.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Preston Battle with the law firm of Baker Donaldson in the Memphis office, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Commercial Bank and Trust Company, which I will refer to as Commercial Bank. The issue before the court today is the correction of a mistake made by Commercial Bank's teller in issuing two teller's checks in the amount of $300,000 to the appellant in his name only on December 4th, 2020. I respectfully ask the court to uphold the district court's findings that Commercial Bank's teller, Judy Lofton, paid the Southern Risk checks by mistake as defined in the first restatement of restitution and as adopted by the Tennessee's version of the UCC, section 418, that the plaintiff in this case did not take the June 6, 2019 check or the March 3rd, 2020 check in good faith or for value, and that the appellant had reason to know that the bank made a mistake in paying the checks on December 4th, 2020, which further entitles the bank to recover its payment. Just to briefly respond to some of the points that came up in the appellant's argument, Mr. Jenkins spoke about comment 3 to section 418 and that the bank's teller in that example in which the funds were refunded to the bank, that the teller did not know that there were insufficient funds in the account. And he concedes on page 18 of his brief that there's nothing in that comment 3 as to why the information as to why the bank believed that the funds were available. And we disagree that an ignorance of a fact cannot be a mistake. I believe that the case law cited in our brief supports the fact that inadvertence, inattention, those can be a simple mistake that can entitle a bank to recover in restitution for the mistaken payment of funds.
I assume the normal process for a bank would be to check to make sure that there's enough funds before issuing the check?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be the bank's normal process. It would be to check.
Was there testimony that she just forgot to do this? Or I know that there was some evidence that she suggested that she was in a hurry, but it seems there might be a dispute of fact about the reason behind it. But so what's the testimony regarding? Did she just say she forgot to do it and she meant to?
Yes, Your Honor. What Judy Lofton testified to specifically, which is in her testimony at Record Entry 24-5, under page 319, page ID 319, she testified that she was working under the assumption that the funds were available and that she did not recall or she did not check the account's balance, and she said she made a mistake. Now, while she says on page ID 323 of her deposition testimony, when I did the transaction, I hurried through it and made a mistake by not checking the balance, there doesn't need to be a reason for the mistake. Under the Restatement of Restitutions, Section 6, as adopted by Comment 3 and in Section 418, all that really matters is that she had the belief that the funds were available, that she assumed that the funds were available. The fact that she articulated that she felt hurried or rushed through the transaction, while that is something to consider, it is not dispositive or even necessary.
Do you think if she had remembered, I do have this duty to check to make sure the funds are available, but I'm knowingly refusing to check for some unknown reason, do you think that would make it a different case and that's the key fact for determining mistake, is that she just forgot to do her due diligence? Or
I think under your example, potentially, because that would bring this case a little bit closer to the Demos case from New Jersey from 1977 under the previous version of 418, in which in that case, the bank made a conscious decision to pay out on the check, just hoping that there was going to be a check that was deposited later that afternoon that would cover the check that was going to the seller of the restaurant group. And so if she, but I'll kind of articulate here, That's not part of the record, right? That is not the facts of this case where there is any evidence whatsoever that Ms. Lofton made a conscious decision to disregard the checking the account balance. She believed a mistaken set of facts. She believed that the funds were available, and she issued the teller's checks for that reason. This is also similar to a case that admittedly we did not cite in our brief, but that is cited in comment 4 to section 418, which is National Savings and Trust Company versus Park Corporation, which is 722 Federal 2nd 1303, which is a Sixth Circuit case from 1983.
In the future, if that happens, you can file a letter telling us that you're going to rely on that case at argument.
Oh, thank you. I was not aware of that, so I appreciate that. And I do apologize.
It's really unfair to the other side because they may not have read the case, but we will look at it. But
yes, Your Honor. Just to go back, in that case, there was a mistaken payment, and the court found that there was a mistake that would allow restitution, but and this is quoting from the court, unfortunately for the bank, the platform officer did not see the checks coming in for collection, and neither employee of the bank that were involved in the processing of this check, neither of them followed the bank's standard procedure and checked the account, the drawer's account, to ensure that it held sufficient funds to cover the check. That was also a case in which the court found or rejected the plaintiff's argument that the bank was in a better position to know the true facts and guard against mistakes, and that's because the payee of the check knew that there were insufficient funds to cover the check that was paid.
Well, there's some dispute here whether he knew or didn't know. He had this text exchange. And, you know, in tort law, there's sometimes this concept of if multiple parties are at fault, the party who has the last chance to avoid the injury is the one we ultimately find liable. And here it feels to me that the teller was the last person who could have avoided the wrongful payment here by simply checking, and she didn't. And so, and you know, under some tort principles, it might make sense to lay the fault at the feet of the bank rather than Mr. Goodman.
Yes, Judge Rayler, to address the first part of your question, I think it's undisputed, as we just heard from Mr. Jenkins, I think it's undisputed that the appellant did know that there were insufficient funds in the account because of the text messages.
Well, he wasn't sure. I mean, some of the text said that money's coming, and then the other thing said stop. You know who's going to know? You, your bank. So he's going to go to the bank, he's going to present the checks. If you pay them, he thinks, great, you must be the money there. If you don't pay them, it's because there's no money there.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a pretty good way to, if you're unclear, that's a pretty good way to check ordinarily.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. In a tort law situation, the party that has the last opportunity to avoid the injury, right, that is a relevant consideration. And certainly here, the bank could have, the teller could have checked. However, under UCC Article 3 and under Section 418, it provides for a situation in which a teller or a bank can recover its payment because of a mistake, because of this lapse in judgment, this inattention or inadvertence. And so this is a specially created rule that is adopted in Tennessee and provides for the simplicity and uniformity of commercial transactions in Tennessee and in states that have adopted the UCC. So it's a special made rule, and it does, in this situation, it does replace or supplant the common law, the tort consideration.
Can I switch to the good faith and fair value? So the language says a person who took the instrument in good faith and fair value. And I was curious, which instrument is at issue in this case? Is it, or both? Is it the Southern check, Southern risk check, the personal, I don't know what type, whatever, personal check versus
right,
versus the teller's check. So you could say if Goodman took the Southern risk check, then the inquiry would be whether there was value in exchange, and that goes to the settlement. But if the issue is the teller's check, and if he took the teller's check in a good faith and for value, then the inquiry would be, did the bank receive something Or did he give something of value in return for the teller's check? And we all know that the Southern risk checks were no good. So why wouldn't that make it a very simple case that there was no for value because the Southern risk checks were kind of deficient?
Right. I believe that one does need to look at both. The district court obviously looked at the actual taking of the Southern risk checks from the appellant or from Mr. Martinick by the appellant and looked at whether there was good faith and value in taking those checks, but then also in negotiating the Southern risk checks for the two teller's checks, knowing that those checks were essentially worthless from the moment that he got those checks to the moment that he negotiated those checks on December 4th, 2020. I believe looking at both.
But you didn't, which I thought you were, that's what I was curious about, because in your briefs you really focused on the first.
Yes, Your Honor.
So did you waive focusing on the second, which I thought might make this an even easier case?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't believe that I waived the taking of the arguing that the taking of the teller's checks, those neither being in good faith nor for value, because the lack of good faith and value underlying the Southern risk checks, which certainly we did cover in our brief, that applies also to the negotiation of the teller's checks as well. There was no value in the cold checks, the stales checks that were negotiated as discussed in the district court's opinion, and there was reason to know that on the part of the appellant that those checks were stale and were cold when negotiated.
What do you, that's another question, the reason to know that the checks are insufficient. So that's in the comment, the comment three or whatever, and it's also in the restatement of restitution. Reason to know that the check was paid by mistake when payment was received. But it's not in the text of the Tennessee Code provision. It just is good faith and for value. It seems like there's three elements, good faith and for value and reason to know that it's, no reason to know that it's not a mistake. How does the comment map onto the statute or the, like if the statute doesn't include that language, usually one implication is that that's not an additional element. But the district court seemed to say that was an independent ground for finding C satisfied. So I was curious how you thought the two were reconciled.
Yes, Your Honor. And the district court cites at page ID 508, which is record entry 31, which is the summary judgment order, cites Tennessee Code annotated 471103C, which states, in any dispute as to the proper construction of one or more sections of chapters 1 through 9 of this title, the official comments pertaining to the corresponding sections of the UCC in effect in July 1, 2013 in this state shall constitute evidence of the purposes and policies underlying such sections. And
that would seem to suggest that the words that are actually used, the comments help explain what those mean. I think Judge Murphy's question was, the district judge seemed to identify an additional test that's not articulated in the words of the statute, which is a different question, I think, than what you answered.
Okay, I understand.
So just to put it in context, that would say if there's an ambiguity in the text of the statute, a comment can help resolve the ambiguity. But we first have to find an ambiguity, and I'm curious how you would put this knowledge that the check is doesn't have sufficient funds into the text of C.
Well, and I think the fact that I think it's relevant to taking in good faith, and so the section C, which says that the remedy under subsection B is not available, right under subsection C, if the payee took for good faith, in good faith, and for value, I think that it's relevant to that good faith piece. I'm not sure if I go so far as I think good faith it is. Under Tennessee law, that is a bit of a subjective standard, and so it's important to look into the comments that way, which the comments do reference.
I thought that was one potential, as if good faith is ambiguous, this could be, but in both the restatement of restitution and in this comment, they seem to be like alternative. Like it says good faith for value and knowledge that the check had insufficient funds, so that would maybe cut against that, but But I see your point that it could be the way we interpret good faith.
Yes, Your Honor. And just to point out, that's Section 33 of the Restatement of Restitution, which talks about without reason to know that the drawee is mistaken. And the district court found all three of these, this was on all fours of the statute. I do believe that the appellant failed to discuss that in his brief as well. And I ask that this court affirm the summary judgment order.
Sure. Judge Kethledge, do you have any questions for the appellee?
Yeah, just a couple of quick ones. Mr. Battle, this is just a general question. My understanding is that when a state legislature adopts the Uniform Commercial Code, the legislature itself, as part of the legislation, the comments are part of the legislation. Is that your understanding of what happened in, was it Tennessee or Kentucky here? I'm sorry.
Tennessee, Your Honor.
Yeah, it's in Tennessee. So is that what happened in Tennessee?
I am not sure as to that specific question, if it adopts the comments as part of the language of the statute. Just that section 103C states that the comments are the best evidence of the purposes and policies underlying such sections.
Yeah, okay. Well, we can chase that down, but I think this could be the unusual circumstance where the legislature itself enacted, so to speak, these comments. The other question I had for you is just on the issue of value. And Mr. Jenkins basically says that the value is his client's promise not to sue Martinique. And it would seem that his client's testimony is enough to create a genuine issue as to whether these two guys had some agreement with respect to paying checks on the one hand or paying money on the one hand and not bringing suit on the other. And so if that's the case, why isn't Goodman's promise value for purposes of the UCC analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that there was a promise or that there was that good of a promise, because Mr. Goodman testified in his deposition at record entry 273408, or that's, I believe, actually his declaration, excuse me, that he still might sue Mr. Martinick. And so the district court found that, in addition, that there was a disagreement to the total amount owed, disagreement as to whether there was any liability whatsoever, and the fact that Mr. Goodman gave up nothing, while he may have promised that said that there was an agreement that he was going to waive his negligence claims or give up his negligence claims, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth a little bit by saying that he still might bring an action and still might sue Mr. Martinick. And so I don't believe that there is value there, because there.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
I get it. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Jenkins?
Yes, sir.
But before you begin, if within 7 days you want to, in writing, submit a response to the case that was mentioned this morning, we'd be happy to do that. Maybe in accordance, I think it's a 350-word limit, but if you'd like to do that, you're welcome to. You don't have to.
I probably will, Your Honor. But I've written down that case, and I'll go read it after we're finished. And I'll also go back and look at that rule about the letters. So I think the way I want to close is just to say that, to quote from the restatement restitution at section 6, which says, "One who knows that he is ignorant is not mistaken, since he has no belief as to the existence or non-existence of facts." And then to quote from Ms. Lofton's testimony, "All I can tell you is, in my mind, I was just rushed
and rushed through the transaction to get Mr. Goodman taken care of, and I just failed to check the balance of the Southern Risk account. That's at page ID 322 and 323 in the district court record. The fact is, Ms. Lofton did not believe that the money was there. She assumed, that's what she's taking her testimony at face value, she assumed the money is there. That is not a belief. She just skipped that part of the transaction, and the detailed part of her deposition says that she thought she must have just crossed out the screen, that she just X'd out of the screen that came up that told her to check the balance. And in fact, that's what the answer to the complaint indicated that she had done, that she had failed to look at the warning that came up on the screen. This is not a case about...
Wasn't it a mistake to not look at that warning?
Well,
that was a mistake.
So that was not correct. What I would say to that is, Your Honor, what we've been saying since the very beginning in this case, and what the restatement of restitution says is that, and what Hawkland says, in fact, is that it has to be a mistake about facts. It has to be a mistaken belief about facts. And the two, as I said, the two comments, the one about the father giving the daughter the check, $10,000 check for the birthday, it says specifically as an assumption in the comment that the bank employee believed that the money was there. And then in the check kiting scheme example, it says specifically that the bank was paying those checks over uncollected funds in the belief that, mistaken belief that those funds would be collected. It can't be the answer to this inquiry under any practical consideration of the words of the statute or the actual facts of this case, that somebody can walk into a bank, hand them a check that's drawn on that bank. They have the clearly absolute ability to know or not know whether that check is good, pay the check without doing anything to protect themselves, and then after the fact say, oh, sorry, we made a mistake. That doesn't, in my assertion, that doesn't make any, that's not a sensible way to interpret the statute. And there are plenty of exit ramps off that nonsensical conclusion, one of which is the plain meaning of the statute, one of which is that language from Restatement First of Restitution, Section 6, and one of which is that it was a disputed issue of fact in any event because of the testimony that Ms. Lofton gave. And given that, we never get to the operation of subsection C of 418. It stops at B because there's not a mistake, a qualifying mistake, as I called it, and as Hawkland alludes to, that we cited in our reply brief. And with that, I've got 5 seconds, and I'll wait the rest of my time. Thank you.
Judge Kethledge, do you have any questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
Thank you to both the parties. The case will be submitted.